Black Boy, Disc 14.
I sat one morning in Ross's home with his wife and child. I was scribbling furiously upon my yellow sheets of paper. The doorbell rang, and Ross's wife admitted a black communist, one Ed Green. He was tall, taciturn, soldierly, square-shouldered. I was introduced to him, and he nodded stiffly. "What's happening here?" he asked bluntly. Ross explained my project to him, and as Ross talked, I could see Ed Green's face darken. He hadn't sat down, and when Ross's wife offered him a chair, he didn't hear her. "What are you going to do with these notes?" he asked me. "I hope to weave them into stories," I said. "What are you asking the party members?" "About their lives in general?" "Who suggested this to you?" he asked. "Nobody. I thought of it myself." "Were you ever a member of any other political group?" "I worked with the Republicans once," I said. "I mean revolutionary organizations," he asked. "No. Why do you ask?" "What kind of work do you do?" "I sweep the streets for a living." "How far did you go in school?" "Through the grammar grades." "You talk like a man who went further than that," he said. "Why would I lie to you about my education?" I asked. "I don't know," he said, looking directly at me. "I've read books. I taught myself." "You know about Ross's indictment?" he asked. "Yes." "I don't know," he said, looking off. "What do you mean?" I asked. "What's wrong?" "To whom have you shown this material?" "I've shown it to no one yet." What was the meaning of his questions? Naively, I thought that he himself would make a good model for a biographical sketch. "I'd like to interview you next," I said. "I'm not interested," he snapped. His manner was so rough that I didn't urge him. He called Ross into a rear room. I sat feeling that I was guilty of something. In a few minutes, Ed Green returned, stared at me wordlessly, then marched out. "Who does he think he is?" I asked Ross. "He's a member of the Central Committee," Ross said. "But why does he act like that?" "Oh, he's always like that," Ross said uneasily. There was a long silence. "He's wondering what you're doing with this material," Ross said finally. I looked at him. He, too, had been captured by suspicion. He was trying to hide the fear in his face. "You don't have to tell me anything you don't want to," I said. That seemed to soothe him for a moment, but the seed of doubt had already been planted. I felt dizzy. Was I mad? Or were these people mad? "You see, Dick," Ross's wife said, "Ross is under an indictment. Ed Green is the representative of the International Labor Defense for the South Side. It's his duty to keep track of the people he's trying to defend. He wanted to know if Ross has given you anything that could be used against him in court." I was speechless. "What does he think I am?" I demanded. There was no answer. "You lost people," I cried and banged my fist on the table. Ross was shaken and ashamed. "Oh, Ed Green's just super cautious," he mumbled. "Ross," I asked, "do you trust me?" "Oh, yes," he said uneasily. We two black men sat in the same room, looking at each other in fear. Both of us were hungry. Both of us depended upon public charity to eat and for a place to sleep. Yet we had more doubt in our hearts of each other than of the men who had cast the mold for our lives. Self-consciously, we went on with the work, but something was gone out of it. Did they think I was gathering material for the police? How could I make them understand what I was trying to do? I found that when I talked to them in abstract terms, my ideas weren't understood. The irony of it was that I, who had all but to steal books to read, had been branded as an intellectual by the one group that claimed it was dedicated to educating the oppressed and informing them with a vision of life. I was doubted by those who shared more of my life than any others could possibly share of it. I couldn't doubt the sincerity of Ed Green. His was a long and militant record in the Communist Party. Then why was he suspicious of me? And if he doubted me, whom could he ever trust? If I was an intellectual, then what was a Negro doctor, lawyer, teacher? The thing just didn't make sense. Yet there it was. Ed Green was afterwards killed in action while fighting for the Spanish loyalists. He knew how to die better than he knew how to live. He was organically capable of only the most elementary reactions. His fear-haunted life made him suspicious of everything that didn't look as he looked, that didn't act as he acted, that didn't talk as he talked, that didn't feel as he felt. His existence both gladdened and frightened me. I was glad that he was militant, but I was frightened when I pondered upon what he could do with his militancy. The only people he could move to believe in him were those who shared his own world of fear, and all the world that lay beyond his terribly restricted vision was enemy ground. I wanted to make the lives of these men known through the images already accepted as the common coin of communication. I wanted to make them know that they had allies, that more people than they knew, and in ways they didn't understand, were their friends, and that I was their friend. I wanted to voice the words in them that they couldn't say, to be a witness for their living. And they were wondering if I were in league with the police. I had embraced their aims with the freest impulse I had ever known. I, the cherry cynic, the man who had felt that no idea on earth was worthy of self-sacrifice, had publicly identified myself with them, and now their suspicion of me hit with a terrific impact, froze me within. I groped in the noon sun. What was I after? They wanted to know. And when I tried to explain, I always, it seemed, said the wrong things. There were no concrete charges that they could bring against me. They were simply afraid of that which was not familiar. They were more fearful of my ideas than they would have been had I held a gun on them. They could have taken the gun away from me and shot me with it. But they didn't know what to do with ideas. I talked with white communists about my experiences with black communists, and I couldn't make them understand what I was talking about. White communists had idealized all Negroes to the extent that they didn't see the same Negroes I saw. And the more I tried to explain my ideas, the more they too began to suspect that I was somehow dreadfully wrong. Words lost their usual meanings. Simple motives took on sinister colors. Attitudes underwent quick and startling transformations. Ideas turned into their opposites while you were talking to a person you thought you knew. I began to feel an emotional isolation that I hadn't known in the depths of the hate-ridden South. I continued to take notes on Ross's life, but each successive morning found him more reticent. I pitied him and didn't argue with him, for I knew that persuasion would not nullify his fears. Instead, I sat and listened to him and his friends tell tales of Southern Negro experience, noting them down in my mind, not daring to ask questions for fear they would become alarmed. In spite of their fears, I became quite drenched in the details of their lives. I gave up the idea of the biographical sketches and settled finally upon writing a series of short stories using the material I had got from Ross and his friends, building upon it, inventing. I wove a tale of a group of black boys trespassing upon the property of a white man, and the lynching that followed. The story was published in an anthology under the title of Big Boy Leaves Home, but its appearance came too late to influence the communists who were questioning the use to which I was putting their lives. My fitful work assignments from the relief officials ceased, and I looked for work that didn't exist. I borrowed money to ride to and fro on the club's business. I found a cramped attic for my mother and aunt and brother behind some railroad tracks. At last, the relief authorities placed me in the Southside Boys Club, and my wages were just enough to provide a deficient diet. Then political problems rose to plague me. Ross, whose life I had tried to write, was charged by the Communist Party with anti-leadership tendencies, class collaborationist attitudes, and ideological factionalism, phrases so fanciful that I gaped when I heard them. And it was rumored that I, too, would face similar charges. It was known that I had visited Ross, had taken notes on his life, and it was believed that I had been politically influenced by him, though in what way was not stated. As before, the more I tried to explain, the guiltier I seemed in the eyes of my comrades. I'd taken part in the formation of none of the policies of the Communist Party, had expressed no opinion regarding its leadership or work, but the rumors of my disaffection persisted. One night a group of black comrades came to my house and warned me against believing in Ross's ideas. When I assured them that I didn't share Ross's views, they ordered me to stay away from him. "But why?" I demanded. "He's an unhealthy element," they said. "Can't you accept a decision?" "Is this a decision of the Communist Party?" "Yes," they said. "If I were guilty of something, I'd feel bound to keep your decision," I said. "But I've done nothing." "Comrade, you don't understand," they said. "Members of the party don't violate the party's decisions." "But your decision doesn't apply to me," I said. "I'll be damned if I'll act as if it does." "Your attitude does not merit our trust," they said. I was angry. "Look," I exploded, rising and sweeping my arms at the bleak attic in which I lived. "What is it here that frightens you? You know where I work? You know what I earn? You know my friends? Now what in God's name is wrong?" They laughed with mirthless smiles, which implied that I would soon know what was wrong. But there was relief from these shadowy political bouts. I found my work in the Southside Boys Club deeply engrossing. Each day, black boys between the ages of 8 and 25 came to swim, draw, and read. They were a wild and homeless lot, culturally lost, spiritually disinherited, candidates for the clinics, morgues, prisons, reformatories, and the electric chair of the state's death house. For hours, I listened to their talk of planes, women, guns, politics, and crime. Their figures of speech were as forceful and colorful as any ever used by English-speaking people. I kept pencil and paper in my pocket to jot down their word rhythms and reactions. These boys didn't fear people to the extent that every man looked like a spy. The communists who doubted my motives didn't know these boys, their twisted dreams, their all-too-clear destinies. And I doubted if I'd ever be able to convey to them the tragedy I saw here. Wrestling with words gave me my moments of deepest meaning. The short story, Big Boy Leaves Home, had posed a question. What quality of will must a Negro possess to live and die with dignity in a country that denied his humanity? There took shape in my mind, as though an answer was trying to grope its way out of the depths of me, the tale of a flood, down by the riverside. I waded into it, feeling my way, trying to find the answer to my question. but it dissatisfied me when I had finished it. So casting it aside, I tried to say the same thing in yet another way in Long Black Song. But that didn't catch the quality of the experience I was looking for. Party duties broke into my efforts at expression. The club decided upon a conference of all the left-wing writers in the Middle West. I supported the idea and argued that the conference should deal with craft problems. My arguments were rejected. The conference, the club decided, would deal with political questions. I asked for a definition of what was expected from the writers, books or political activity. Both was the answer. Write a few hours a day and march on the picket line the other hours. I pointed out that the main concern of a revolutionary artist was to produce revolutionary art, and that the future of the club was in doubt if a clear policy couldn't be found. The conference convened with a leading communist attending as advisor. The question debated was, what did the Communist Party expect from the club? The answer of the communist leader ran from organizing to writing novels. I argued that either a man organized or he wrote novels. The party leader said that both must be done. The attitude of the party leader prevailed, and Left Front, for which I had worked so long, was voted out of existence. The party leader demanded that writers be assigned the task of producing pamphlets for the use of trade unions. I contended that it would be a mistake for the Communist Party to persuade writers to abandon imaginative work to write pamphlets. I explained the advantages that could be derived from the long-term artistic products of the club's writers and pointed out that these more durable products would outweigh all the pamphleteering. This, too, was rejected by vote. I then appealed for an organizational structure that would include provisions for artistic work of all types, hoping in this way to eliminate constant quarrels over tactics and strategy. But all my proposals were voted down. I knew now that the club was nearing its end, and I rose and stated my gloomy conclusions, recommending that the club dissolve. My defeatism, as it was called, brought upon my head the sharpest disapproval of the party leader. The conference ended with the passing of a multitude of resolutions dealing with China, India, Germany, Japan, and conditions afflicting various parts of the earth. But not one idea regarding writing had emerged. The ideas I had expounded at the conference were linked with the suspicions I had roused among the Negro communists on the South Side, and the Communist Party was now certain that it had a dangerous enemy in its midst. It was whispered that I was trying to lead a secret group in opposition to the party. I had learned that denial of accusations was useless. It was now painful to meet a communist, for I didn't know what his attitude would be. Following the conference, a national John Reed Club Congress was called. It convened in the summer of 1934, with left-wing writers attending from all states. But as the sessions got underway, there was a sense of looseness, bewilderment, and dissatisfaction among the writers, most of whom were young, eager, and on the verge of doing their best work. No one knew what was expected of him, and out of the Congress came no unifying idea. Through conversations, I learned that the members of the New York John Reed Club were in despair at the way in which the Congress was drifting, but they took care to conceal their disapproval. This puzzled me, for I felt that the problem should be brought into the open for discussion. But I was glad to hear the New York communists express horror at the brutal way in which the Chicago communists made demands upon the Chicago John Reed Club membership. One astonished New York comrade declared, "A Chicago communist is a walking terror." As the Congress drew to a close, I attended a caucus to plan the future of the clubs. 10 of us met in a Loop hotel room, and to my amazement, the leaders of the club's national board confirmed my criticisms of the manner in which the clubs had been conducted. I was excited. Now, I thought, the clubs will be given a new lease on life. Writers would now be free to make their political contributions in the form of their creative work. Then I was stunned when I heard a nationally known communist announce a decision to dissolve the clubs. Why, I asked. Because the clubs don't serve the new People's Front policy, I was told. That can be remedied. The clubs can be made healthy and broad, I said. No, a bigger and better organization must be launched. One in which the leading writers of the nation could be included, they said. I was informed that the People's Front policy was now the correct vision of life, and that the clubs could no longer exist. I asked what was to become of the young writers whom the Communist Party had implored to join the clubs and who were ineligible for the new group, and there was no answer. This thing is cold, I exclaimed to myself. To effect a swift change in policy, the Communist Party was dumping one organization, scattering its members, then organizing a new scheme with entirely new people. I had sacrificed energy to recruit writers who subscribed to a revolutionary point of view, and now my feelings fought against the waste and meaninglessness to which my efforts were being reduced. This was the first time I had sat with a communist policy-making body. I'd had the illusion that each man would have his say, and, out of the facts presented, a decision would be made. I was naive. I had merely been called in to give my approval to a decision previously made. It angered me. I found myself arguing alone against the majority opinion, and then I made still another amazing discovery. I saw that even those who agreed with me wouldn't support me. At that meeting, I learned that when a man was informed of the wish of the party, he submitted, even though he knew with all the strength of his brain that the wish wasn't a wise one, was one that would ultimately harm the party's interests. I had heard communists discuss discipline in the abstract, but when I saw it, in its concrete form, it tore my feelings. It wasn't courage that made me oppose the party. I simply didn't know any better. It was inconceivable to me, though bred in the lap of Southern hate, that a man could not have his say. I had spent a third of my life traveling from the place of my birth to the North just to talk freely, to escape the pressure of fear. And now I was facing fear again, though I had no notion that I was slowly adding faggots to a flame that would soon blaze over my head with all the violence of the assault I had sustained when I had naively thought I could learn the optical trade in Mississippi. The artist and the politician stand at opposite poles. The artist enhances life by his prolonged concentration upon it, while the politician emphasizes the impersonal aspects of life by his attempts to fit men into groups. The artist's enhancement of life may emphasize at certain times those aspects that a politician can use, but the politician at other times, eager to do good for man, may sneer at the artist because the art product cannot be used by him. Hence the two groups of men, driving in the same direction, committed to the same vision, often find themselves locked in a struggle more desperate than either of them wanted, while their mutual enemies gape at the spectacle in amazement. Why didn't we writers leave the realm of politics and organize ourselves? We simply didn't know how. We were hostile toward our environment, and we didn't know how other American writers had met such problems. Totally at odds with our culture, we wanted nothing less than to make anew. And for our examples, we looked toward Russia, Germany, and France. Out of step with our times, it was but natural for us to respond to the Communist Party, which said, "Your rebellion is right. Come with us, and we will support your vision with militant action." Indeed, we felt that we were lucky. Why cower in towers of ivory and squeeze out private words when we had only to speak and millions listened? Our writing was translated into French, German, Russian, Chinese, Spanish, Japanese. Who had ever, in all human history, offered to young writers an audience so vast? True, our royalties were small, or less than small, but that didn't matter. We wrote what we felt. Confronted with a picture of a revolutionary and changing world, there spilled out of our hearts our reaction to that world, our hope, our anger at oppression, our dreams of a new life. It spilled without coercion, without the pleading of anyone. Before the Congress adjourned, it was decided that another Congress of American Writers would be called in New York the following summer, 1935. I was lukewarm to the proposal and tried to make up my mind to stand alone, write alone. I was already afraid that the stories I had written wouldn't fit into the new official mood. Must I discard my plot ideas and seek new ones? No, I couldn't. My writing was my way of seeing, my way of living, my way of feeling. And who could change his sight, his notion of direction, his senses? My relationship with communists reached a static phase. I shunned them, and they shunned me. Buddy Nielsen, a member of the Communist International, had arrived in Chicago to assume charge of Negro work. The man, it was rumored, was the party's theoretician on the Negro question, and word reached me that he had launched a campaign to rid the Communist Party of all its Negro Trotskyite elements. Of all the Negro communists I knew, I tried to determine who could be called a Trotskyite, and I could think of none. None of the black communists I knew possessed the intellectual capacity to formulate a Trotskyite position in politics. Most of them were illiterate migrants from southern plantations, and they had never been vitally interested in politics until they had entered the Communist Party. Nevertheless, the drive against Negro Trotskyism went on, though I was too remote from it to know what was happening. The spring of 1935 came, and the plans for the Writers' Congress went on apace. For some obscure reason, it might have been to save me, I was urged by the local communists to attend, and I was named as a delegate. I got time off from my job at the Southside Boys Club, and along with several other delegates, hitchhiked to New York. Long used to the flat western prairie, I was startled by my first view of New York. We came in along the Hudson River, and I stared at the sweep of clean-kept homes and grounds. But where was the smoke pall, the soot, grain elevators, factories, stackpipes, the flashes of steam on the horizon? The people on the sidewalks seemed better dressed than the people of Chicago. Their eyes were bold and impersonal. They walked with a quicker stride and seemed intent upon reaching some destination in a great hurry. We arrived in the early evening and registered for the Congress sessions. The opening mass meeting was being held at Carnegie Hall. I asked about housing accommodations, and the New York John Reed Club members, all white members of the Communist Party, looked embarrassed. I waited while one white communist called another white communist to one side and discussed what could be done to get me, a black Chicago communist, housed. During the trip, I hadn't thought of myself as a Negro. I had been mulling over the problems of the young left-wing writers I knew. Now, as I stood watching one white comrade talk frantically to another about the color of my skin, I felt disgusted. The white comrade returned. "Just a moment, comrade," he said to me. "I'll get a place for you." "But haven't you places already?" I asked. "Matters of this sort are ironed out in advance." "Yes," he admitted in an intimate tone. "We have some addresses here, but we don't know the people. You understand?" "Yes, I understand," I said, gritting my teeth. "But just wait a second," he said, touching my arm to reassure me. "I'll find something." "Listen, don't bother," I said, trying to keep anger out of my voice. Oh, no, he said, shaking his head determinedly. This is a problem and I'll solve it. It oughtn't to be a problem, I couldn't help saying. Oh, I didn't mean that. He caught himself quickly. God damn, I cursed under my breath. Several people standing nearby observed the white communist trying to find a black communist a place to sleep. I burned with shame. A few minutes later, the white communist returned, frantic-eyed, sweating. Did you find anything? I asked. No, not yet, he said, panting. Just a moment. I'm going to call somebody I know. Say, give me a nickel for the phone. Forget it, I said. My legs felt like water. I'll find a place, but I'd like to put my suitcase somewhere until after the meeting tonight. Do you really think you can find a place? He asked, trying to keep a note of desperate hope out of his voice. Of course I can, I said. He was still uncertain. He wanted to help me, but he didn't know how. He locked my bag in a closet, and I stepped to the sidewalk wondering where Harlem was, wondering where I would sleep that night. Before I had left Chicago, I thought of 1,000 arguments to present for the retention of the John Reed clubs. But now, the retention of those clubs didn't seem important. I stood on the sidewalks of New York with a black skin, practically no money, and I was not absorbed with the burning questions of the left-wing literary movement in the United States, but with the problem of how to get a bath. I presented my credentials at Carnegie Hall. The building was jammed with people. As I listened to the militant speeches, I found myself wondering why in hell I had come. I went to the sidewalk and stood studying the faces of the people. The white communist, who had been scouting for a room in which I could sleep, ran up to me. Did you find a place yet? No, I answered. Well, here's a name and address, he said proudly. Go there, and they'll put you up for tonight. Thanks, I said, glad to have a place to flop. When the meeting ended, I retrieved my bag from the club and found the address in a dark alley of Greenwich Village. I knocked at the door. A white man opened it, took one quick look at my face, then pushed the door almost shut again, as though in desperate defense of himself and his home. What do you want? The words spilled out of him. I asked for the name of the person written on the slip of paper I had. They aren't here, he said. When will they return? I asked. I don't know, he spluttered, inching the door to. I walked away. How could I sleep in a home where the sight of my face struck fear into people? I returned to the club and saw a few of the white comrades standing about the sidewalk. I crossed to the opposite side of the street to avoid them. I approached a newsstand merchant. It was nearing 3 o'clock. Where is Harlem? I asked. He stared at me. I lost my temper. For God's sake, I exploded. I'm a stranger here. I'm asking you where Harlem is. He blinked and pointed vaguely. That way, he said. His directions didn't help me. I walked on. I met a Chicago club member. Didn't you find a place yet? He asked. No, I said. I'd like to try one of the hotels, but God, I'm in no mood to argue with a hotel clerk about my color. Oh, God damn, wait a minute, he said. I waited as he scooted off. He returned in a few moments with a big, heavy white woman. He introduced us. You can sleep in my place tonight, she said. I walked with her to her apartment, and she introduced me to her husband. I thanked them for their hospitality and went to sleep on a cot in the kitchen. I got up at 6, dressed, tapped on their door, and bade them goodbye. I went to the sidewalk, sat on a bench, took out pencil and paper, and tried to jot down notes for the argument I wanted to make in defense of the John Reed clubs. But again, the problem of the clubs didn't seem important. What did seem important was, could a Negro ever live halfway like a human being in this goddamn country? That day, I sat through the Congress sessions, but what I heard didn't touch me. That night, I found my way to Harlem and walked pavements filled with black life. I was amazed when I asked passers-by to learn that there were practically no hotels for Negroes in Harlem. I kept walking. Finally, I saw a tall, clean hotel. Black people were passing the doors, and no white people were in sight. Confidently, I entered and was surprised to see a white clerk behind the desk. I hesitated. "I'd like a room," I said. "Not here," he said. "But isn't this Harlem?" I asked. "Yes, but this hotel is for white only," he said. "Where's a hotel for colored?" "You might try the Y," he said. "In what direction is it?" "Keep walking that way," he said, pointing. Half an hour later, I found the Negro Young Men's Christian Association, that bulwark of Jim Crowism for young black men, got a room, took a bath, and slept for 12 hours. When I awakened, I didn't want to go to the Congress. I lay in bed thinking, I've got to go it alone. I've got to learn how again. I dressed and attended the meeting that was to make the final decision to dissolve the clubs. It started briskly. A New York communist writer summed up the history of the clubs and made a motion for their dissolution. Debate started, and I rose and explained what the clubs had meant to young writers and begged for their continuance. I sat down amid silence. Debate was closed. The vote was called. The room filled with uplifted hands to dissolve. Then there came a call for those who disagreed, and my hand went up, alone. I knew that my stand would be interpreted as one of opposition to the Communist Party, but I thought, the hell with it. New York held no further interest, and the next morning, I left for home. With the clubs now dissolved, I was free of all party relations. I avoided unit meetings for fear of being subjected to discipline. Occasionally, a Negro communist, defying the code that enjoined him to shun suspect elements, came to my home and informed me of the current charges that communists were bringing against one another. To my astonishment, I heard that Buddy Nielsen had branded me a smuggler of reaction. "Why does he call me that?" I asked. "He says that you are a petty bourgeois degenerate," I was told. "What does that mean?" "He says that you are corrupting the party with your ideas," I was told. "How?" There was no answer. I decided that my relationship with the party was about over. I would have to leave it. The attacks were growing worse, and my refusal to react incited Nielsen into coining more absurd phrases. I was termed a bastard intellectual, an incipient Trotskyite. It was claimed that I possessed an anti-leadership attitude and that I was manifesting seraphim tendencies, the latter phrase meaning that one has withdrawn from the struggle of life and considers oneself an infallible angel. I couldn't dismiss these charges lightly, for a frantic, hysterical hunt was going on then in the ranks of the party for Trotskyites. In the Soviet Union, men were being shot for Trotskyism. I used to lie awake nights wondering what would happen to me if I lived in the Soviet Union. Working all day and writing half the night brought me down with a severe chest ailment. I was in constant pain, scarcely able to breathe. I lay reviewing the life I had lived in the party, and I found it distasteful. I realized that I hadn't been objective in my quixotic fight to save the clubs. I had been fighting as much for myself as for them. But was that wrong? Again, I resolved to leave the party, for the emotional cost of membership was too high. While I was ill, a knock came at my door one morning. My mother admitted Ed Green, the man who had demanded to know what use I planned to make of the material I was collecting from the comrades. I stared at him as I lay abed, and I knew that he considered me a clever and sworn enemy of the party. Bitterness welled up in me. "What do you want?" I asked bluntly. "You see, I'm ill." "I have a message from the party for you," he said. I hadn't said good day, and he hadn't offered to say it. He had not smiled, and neither had I. He looked curiously at my bleak room. "This is the home of a bastard intellectual," I cut at him. He stared without blinking. I couldn't endure his standing there so stone-like. Common decency made me say, "Sit down." His shoulders stiffened. "I'm in a hurry." He spoke like an army officer. "What do you want to tell me?" "Do you know Buddy Nielsen?" he asked. "No," I said, "but I've heard of him." I was suspicious. Was this a political trap? They had hurled baseless accusations at me, and I felt that there could be no ground of trust between us. Was he trying to discover if I knew someone whom, politically, I shouldn't know? But after all, Buddy Nielsen was a member of the Communist International. But what if Buddy Nielsen had suddenly been accused of something, and Ed Green was here trying to find out if I knew him? "What about Buddy Nielsen?" I asked, committing myself to nothing, until I knew the kind of reality I was grappling with. "He wants to see you," Ed Green said. I breathed easier. I couldn't meet communists now without feeling a degree of fear. "What about?" I asked, still suspicious. "He wants to talk with you about your party work," he said. "I'm ill, and can't see him until I'm well," I said. Ed Green stood for a fraction of a second, then turned on his heel and marched out of the room. Ought I see Buddy Nielsen? He was the man who had formulated the communist position for the American Negro. He had made speeches in the Kremlin. He had spoken before Stalin himself. Then perhaps he could explain many of the aspects of communism that had baffled me. Anyway, I resolved to confront him and ask him some direct, simple questions and hear what he had to say. When my chest healed, I sought an appointment with Buddy Nielsen. He was a short, black man with an ever-ready smile, thick lips, a furtive manner, and a greasy, sweaty look. His bearing was nervous, self-conscious. He seemed always to be hiding some deep irritation. He spoke in short, jerky sentences, hopping nimbly from thought to thought, as though his mind worked in a free, associational manner. He suffered from asthma, and would snort at unexpected intervals. Now and then he would punctuate his flow of words by taking a nip from a bottle of whiskey. He had traveled half around the world, and his talk was pitted with vague allusions to European cities. I met him in his apartment, listened to him intently, observed him minutely, for I knew that I was facing one of the leaders of world communism. "Hello, Wright," he snorted. "I've heard about you." As we shook hands, he burst into a loud, seemingly causeless laugh. And as he guffawed, I couldn't tell whether his mirth was directed at me or was meant to hide his uneasiness. "I hope what you've heard about me is good," I parried. "Sit down," he laughed again, waving me to a chair. "Yes, they tell me you're right." "I try to," I said. "You can write," he snorted. "I read that article you wrote for the New Masses about Joe Louis. Good stuff. First political treatment of sports we've yet had." "I'm trying to reveal the meaning of Negro experience," I said. "We need a man like you," he said flatteringly. I waited. I had thought that I would encounter a man of ideas, but he wasn't that. Then perhaps he was a man of action. But that wasn't indicated either. As we talked, I tried to grasp the frame of reference of his words so that I would know how to talk to him.
"They tell me that you are a friend of Ross's," he shot at me.
I paused before answering. He hadn't asked me directly, but he had hinted in a neutral, teasing way. Mentally, I prodded myself into remembering that I was speaking to a member of the Communist International. Ross, I'd been told, was slated for expulsion on the grounds that he was anti-leadership. And if a member of the Communist International was asking me if I were a friend of a man about to be expelled, he was indirectly asking me if I were loyal or not.
"Ross is not particularly a friend of mine," I said frankly, "but I know him well, in fact, quite well."
"If he isn't your friend, how do you happen to know him so well?"
he asked, laughing to soften the hard threat of his question.
"I was writing an account of his life, and I know him as well, perhaps, as anybody," I told him.
"I heard about that," he said.
"Right.
Say, let me call you Dick, huh?"
"Go ahead," I said.
"Dick," he said, "Ross is a nationalist."
He paused to let the weight of his accusation sink in. He meant that Ross's militancy was extreme.
"We communists don't dramatize Negro nationalism," he said in a voice that laughed, accused, and drawled.
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"We're not advertising Ross."
He spoke directly now. "We're talking about two different things," I said. "You seem worried about my making Ross popular because he is your political opponent. But I'm not concerned about Ross's politics at all. The man struck me as one who typified certain traits of the Negro migrant. I've already sold a story based upon an incident in his life." Nielsen became excited.
"What was the incident?"
"Some trouble he got into when he was 13 years old," I said. His face looked blank for a second. Then he laughed.
"Oh, I thought it was political," he said, shrugging.
"But I'm telling you that you're wrong about that," I explained. "I'm not trying to fight you with my writing. I've no political ambitions. I'm not trying to hurt or help any particular comrade. You must believe that. I'm trying to depict Negro life."
"Have you finished writing about Ross?" he asked.
"No," I said. "I dropped the idea. Our party members were suspicious of me and were afraid to talk." He laughed.
"You've got to know us better, Dick," he grinned. "I hold a high position in the party. I'll straighten out this misunderstanding."
"I'm not looking for a patron," I said.
"I don't mean that," he said, grinning, snorting. "Here, Dick, have a drink."
"No, thank you."
"Don't you drink?"
"Sometimes." "There are men with whom one can drink, and there are men with whom one cannot drink. Nielsen was one of the men with whom I could not drink." He drank and put the bottle back. He shot me a quick, self-conscious glance. I was tense, but rigidly controlled.
"Dick," he began, "we're short of forces. We're facing a grave crisis."
"The party's always facing a crisis," I said. His smile left, and he stared at me.
"You're not cynical, are you, Dick?" he asked.
"No," I said, "but it's the truth. Each week, each month, there's a crisis."
"You're a funny guy," he said, laughing, snorting again. "But we've got a job to do. We're altering our work. Fascism's the danger. The danger now to all people."
"I understand," I said.
"You were in New York not long ago,"
he said unexpectedly.
"Yes."
"Did you talk with any of the party leaders?"
"No."
"You said nothing to anyone about your work here."
I stared at him.
Was he trying to find out whether I had taken up any of his accusations with the national leadership of the party? Was he trying to determine whether I had influential enough political connections to make trouble for him? I told you that I have no political ambitions, I said.
Yes, he said. They say you didn't want the clubs dissolved.
No, I didn't, I said truthfully. I felt that the ground was being cut from under the feet of the party's best writers.
We've got to defeat the fascists, he said, snorting from asthma, switching his line of thought. We've discussed you and know your abilities. We want you to work with us. We've got to crash out of our narrow way of working and get our message to the church people, students, club people, professionals, middle class.
I've been called names, I said softly. Is that crashing out of the narrow way?
Forget that, he said, laughing.
He hadn't denied the name calling. That meant if I didn't obey him, the name calling would begin again. I don't know if I fit into things, I said openly.
We want to trust you with an important assignment, he said.
What do you want me to do?
We want you to organize a committee against the high cost of living.
The high cost of living? I exclaimed. What do I know about such things?
It's easy. You can learn, he said.
I was in the midst of writing a novel, and he was calling me from it to tabulate the price of groceries. He doesn't think much of what I'm trying to do, I thought. Comrade Nielsen, I said,
a writer who hasn't written anything worthwhile is a most doubtful person. Now, I'm in that category. Yet I think I can write. I don't want to ask for special favors, but I'm in the midst of a book which I hope to complete in 6 months or so. Let me convince myself that I'm wrong about my hankering to write, and then I'll be with you all the way. The party can't wait, he said. You'll find time to write. I work every day for a living, I said, remembering that he was being paid by the party to talk to me. Look, we want to make you a mass leader, he said. But suppose I'm not that kind of material.
He laughed. Not one word that I had said had been seriously considered by him. Our talk was a game. He was trying to outwit me. The feelings of others meant nothing to him.
Dick, he said, turning in his chair and waving his hand as though to brush away an insect that was annoying him. You've got to get to the masses of people.
You've seen some of my work, I said. Isn't it just barely good enough to warrant my being given a chance?
The party can't deal with your feelings, he said.
Maybe I don't belong in the party. I stated it in full.
Oh, no, don't say that, he said, snorting.
He looked at me.
You're blunt. I put things the way I feel them, I said. I want to start in right with you. I've had too damn much crazy trouble in the party.
He laughed and lit a cigarette.
Dick, he said, shaking his head, the trouble with you is that you've been around with those white artists on the north side too much. You even talk like them. You've got to know your own people.
I think I know them, I said, realizing that I could never really talk with him. I've been inside of 3/4 of the Negroes' homes on the south side.
But you've got to work with them, he said.
I was working with Ross until I was suspected of being a spy, I said. There was silence. The doorbell rang, and he admitted his wife, a dark, attractive, European white woman, who carried a book under her arm. She came forward with a wide smile. Nielsen introduced us.
What are you reading? I asked.
A Dracula mystery story, she said, eagerly exhibiting her book. You know, Dick, you and I ought to build Negro culture on the South Side.
I'm asking Nielsen for that chance right now, I said,
wondering what connection there could be between a Dracula mystery and Negro culture.
I want him to organize against high prices, Nielsen told his wife, but he's writing a book.
That oughtn't interfere with his book, she said, sliding easily into a verbal solution of my problem.
I work in the day, I said.
Oh, you'll find time, she said lightly. She left the room, and there was silence. The next word was due to come from the member of the Communist International.
Dick, he spoke seriously now, the party has decided that you are to accept this task.
I was silent. I knew the meaning of what he had said. A decision was the highest injunction that a communist could receive from his party, and to break a decision was to break the effectiveness of the party's ability to act. In principle, I heartily agreed with this, for I knew that it was impossible for working people to forge instruments of political power until they had achieved unity of action. Oppressed for centuries, divided, hopeless, corrupted, misled, they were cynical, as I had once been. And the communist method of unity had been found historically to be the only means of achieving discipline. In short, Nielsen had asked me directly if I were a communist or not. I wanted to be a communist, but my kind of communist. I wanted to shape people's feelings, awaken their hearts. But I couldn't tell Nielsen that. He would only have snorted.
I'll organize the committee and turn it over to someone else, I suggested. You don't want to do this, do you? He asked.
No, I said firmly.
You worked willingly enough to organize white writers, he cut at me.
I was organizing people I understood, I said.
What would you like to do on the South Side, then?
I'd like to organize Negro artists, I said.
But the party doesn't need that now, he said.
I rose, knowing that he had no intention of letting me go after I had organized the committee. I wanted to tell him that I was through, but I wasn't ready to bring matters to a head. I went out angry with myself, angry with him, angry with the party. Well, I hadn't broken the decision, but neither had I accepted it wholly. I had dodged, trying to save time for writing, time to think. Again, I urged myself to quit, but I couldn't do it. I knew that Nielsen wasn't a leader. His mind was too rigid, too limited. I hadn't discerned in him any understanding of life or politics. His approach had been to offer me a drink, and when that had failed, he had threatened. He had tried flattery, and when that had failed, he had hinted at expulsion. If I had been wrong, he certainly hadn't convinced me. In the end, I resolved to work a month, then confront him with my original compromise. My task consisted in attending meetings until the late hours of the night, taking part in discussions, or lending myself, generally along with other communists, in leading the people of the South Side. We debated the housing situation, the best means of forcing the city to authorize open hearings on conditions among Negroes. I gritted my teeth as the daily value of pork chops was tabulated, longing to be at home with my writing. I felt that pork chops were a fundamental item in life, but I preferred that someone else chart their rise and fall in price. Nielsen was cleverer than I, and he confronted me before I had a chance to confront him. I was summoned one night to meet Nielsen and a friend. When I arrived at a Southside hotel, I was introduced to a short, yellow man who carried himself like Napoleon. He wore glasses, kept his full lips pursed, as though he were engaged in perpetual thought. He swaggered when he walked. He spoke slowly, precisely, trying to charge each of his words with more meaning than the words were able to carry. He talked of trivial things in lofty tones. He said that his name was Smith, that he was from Washington,
that he planned to launch a national organization among Negroes to federalize all existing Negro institutions so as to achieve a broad unity of action. The three of us sat at a table facing one another. There were no smiles now. I knew that another and last offer was about to be made to me, and if I didn't accept it, there would be open warfare.
Right? How would you like to go to Switzerland?
Smith asked with dramatic suddenness.
I'd like it, I said, but I'm tied up with work now.
You can drop that, Nielsen said. This is important.
What would I do in Switzerland? I asked.
You'll go as a youth delegate, Smith said. From there you can go to the Soviet Union.
Much as I'd like to, I'm afraid I can't make it, I said honestly. I simply cannot drop the writing I'm doing now.
We sat looking at one another, smoking silently.
Has Nielsen told you how I feel? I asked Smith. Smith didn't answer. He stared at me a long time, then spat.
Right? You're a fool.
I rose. Smith turned away from me. A breath more of anger, and I would have driven my fist into his face. Nielsen laughed sheepishly, snorting.
Was that necessary? I asked, trembling.
I stood recalling how in my boyhood I would have fought until blood ran had anyone said anything like that to me. But I was a man now, and master of my rage, able to control the surging emotions. I put on my hat and walked to the door. Keep cool, I said to myself. Don't let this get out of hand.
This is goodbye, I said.
I walked home. My mind was made up. I would attend the next unit meeting and announce my withdrawal, telling the comrades that I still adhered to the ideological program of the party, but that I didn't want to be bound any longer by the party's decisions.
This ends Disc 14.